All right, so our next speaker is Bill Simpkins. He's a professor with Iowa State University, where he's been for 29 years and recently served a three-year term as department chair. Much of his research interests includes aquitard hydrogeology, aquifer recharge, sustainability, impacts of agriculture on groundwater quality and hydrology, isotope hydrology, virus transport, and public health. He's also a fellow with the Geological Society of America, GSA. He was the 2015 awardee of the George Burke Maxey Distinguished Service Award. I'd also like to point out that many of Bill's students have been coming to this conference for many years and make that long trip from Ames to present posters. And I've known Bill for quite some time, and I think he secretly kind of wants to be a Minnesotan. And part of that's his wife, Kathy, is a Minnesotan. I think that wears off on him. But welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Evan, for that nice introduction. I'll have to relay that back to my wife, Kathy, that you said that. It's a great honor to be here, especially for an Iowan to come across the border and give a talk to this distinguished audience. It's also very gratifying as a professor to have a number of my former students out here that work in the Twin Cities. And also, I brought some students up with me today. One of them is giving a poster, and it's a good feeling to do that. And I think that's why we're in this business, to educate people and to train the next generation. One of the reasons, I guess. I'm also very honored because it was only 2 years ago that I showed up unregistered and I was refused entry to this conference. So somebody apparently went to the bathroom and I snuck in. I think Doug Connell had something to do with actually getting me in here. And then I thought I'd really made it, here to speak. And then this morning I showed up and there was no registration packet for me. And we later located it in the exhibits bin. So thank you for the people that helped me get it in the right spot. Otherwise, I'd be sitting out with an exhibit that doesn't exist, and I don't really know. So anyway, it's just great to be here. And what you're going to see is a fairly rapid-paced talk through a lot of things in Iowa that you may or may not know about, mainly to just kind of raise questions and to get you excited about what might be in Iowa and maybe what's not in Minnesota. So. Anyway, I got to make sure I get my ducks in a row here. Okay. So greetings from Iowa. This is actually a postcard, and I think I actually sent this postcard to somebody in the past, maybe when I was younger. If you come to Iowa, you'll be greeted with fields of opportunities at the border, and then everybody looks like this. Apparently, this is... So we're still, for many people in Minnesota, we still kind of have the Grant Wood motif, but I can assure you that we've kind of grown out of that a little bit. Okay. Oh, sorry. Yeah, there we go. So Iowa is, for those of you that are geographically challenged, Iowa is actually, this pointer's not working here. Should I hit the laser thing here? Oh, here. Should I hit that? Should I hit laser that? Yeah. Okay. There we go. Iowa, located here, south of Minnesota, for those of you that have never been down there. And we're number one in a lot of things. We're number one in ethanol production, number one in corn production. We slipped to number two in bean production, soybean production. We're number 12, apparently, in dairy. And we have 21.9 million hogs, which is one hog for every 7.3 person, I guess. We have 7.3 times as many hogs as people. But we're number one in hogs, too. And we're also a major contributor, along with a lot of other Midwestern states, to the Gulf Hypoxic Zone. Iowa has 3.3 million people, so we have quite a few fewer people in Iowa. And, so how do I get this so that, I guess I have to hit this to advance then, right? Page down. There we go. Okay. So you can see from the brown on the map that Iowa is 93% farmland, having something to do with agriculture. 78% of the farmland is in row crop production, and mostly corn and soybeans. So we're a pretty agricultural state, as you might imagine, and you probably think of us as that way. And we're also a contributor to hypoxia. The flow in this diagram is pretty horrible, so I'll just say that this is Don Goolsbee's kind of red area that shows the kilograms applied, the inputs. Here's the red areas that are the yields, and you can see that the Raccoon River actually is right through here, and we're going to talk about that later, is one of the larger end contributors of everybody. Okay, so that'll come in later in the talk. The hypoxic zone, as many of you know, was big this year until probably the hurricane wiped it out. But anyway, we had a very big zone. So that number seems to be not going down, but it does fluctuate. Groundwater use, some of you are not familiar with this. So a lot of our groundwater is used for public supply. We have a certain amount of industrial stuff. We don't irrigate that much in Iowa, so we don't have to worry about that very much. You get them up in the sandy areas of the northern part of the state, and sometimes for test plots where they want to make sure they have a rainfall. And then about 79% of Iowa's water is drinking water. From groundwater. So this is my class that I'm teaching that actually is having a test today. That's great. I love it, except for the people that decided instead to come to this talk. So they're taking it tomorrow. So there's no rest. Okay, so what is the blueprint of agriculture? And we're going to go through a lot of different things here. So they may seem totally unrelated, but at the end I hope to kind of tie them all together. So we're going to start with something that you may not think about as being agriculture, which is ethanol. Ethanol itself is a big player in the Iowa scene for a lot of different levels. Let's see if that works. Oh, yeah, cool. I got it. So this is the Lincoln Way Energy Plant in Nevada, Iowa. It's been there for a long time. It actually is on city water, and I'll talk about that in a second. But this is very close to Ames, so we have that. We can see it from Ames, all right? Let's see, the ethanol plants, we have 43 of them, and we also have 12 biodiesel plants. I'm not going to talk about that. We have two cellulosic ethanol kind of pilot plants. Interestingly enough, the one by DuPont in the city of Nevada that took on to the corn ethanol plant was recently decommissioned. They've stopped production, and they're trying to sell it because apparently they produced 1 gallon of cellulosic ethanol in 2 years. That doesn't seem to be working out real well for them, okay? So that's it. Now, here's some things that you may not realize. About 47% of the corn grown in Iowa produces this ethanol, all right? So we get 4 billion gallons of corn ethanol at about 43 biorefineries, as I said before. And if you run around the landscape, most corn, okay, here we go. No, this has come off. Okay, there we go. Okay, most corn within a 30-mile radius of a biorefinery goes to that plant, all right? And there are numerous water quality effects that have been documented. I'm not going to talk about them, of doing continuous corn, decreasing CRP land to crop more corn, all that kind of stuff is out there. I just want to talk about the water use because I think that's the most germane to our discussion here. Corn ethanol production has risen, and you'll see now that we've kind of plateaued at about 4 billion gallons here. You can see things took off to at about 2004, and they flattened out quite a bit. And that's primarily because of the RFS standard. We're at kind of a plateau at this point, and there's continual machinations about that part, but I won't get into that totally. There were some early concerns about groundwater withdrawals in this process in Iowa. This was an article that you may have seen by Conrad Wilson in City Pages. I was actually called by somebody in Minnesota to talk about this. Amazing. But it turns out that if you look actually at what's going on, we've kind of plateaued on that too. We got up to about 7 billion gallons of water. And you'll notice here that the N is only 24 for this set. And that's because the only water use that we really know about is water use that for people that applied for a high capacity well permit. If they're hooked into city water or rural water, they don't have to report how much they're using in Iowa. So we have no idea what their efficiency is in water use or anything like that, which I think is a water resource issue, but I digress. All right, so anyway, and the other thing I want to point out here, I'll just finish with that, is that ethanol is about 15% of our industrial use. So it's not really a big issue. What is a bigger issue is where it's being used. So our most sensitive aquifer at this point is the Cambria Ordovician aquifer, the Jordan, which is used a lot for municipalities. And so we have a protected rule which limits in three different tiers what we can actually take out of that aquifer depending on what the water level is. And you can see here in the Jordan on the next slide that if you spread this, this is a model development here, if you spread this out to 2029 and increase water by 50%, you can see that there are some fairly significant drawdowns of 450 feet from pre-development levels down here around Fort Dodge and over here in Marion County, or Linn County, where Marion and Cedar Rapids are. So this is one of the main concerns in Iowa, and so it is protected. They have to get a certain permit to take water out of it. The interesting thing is that Prestige Farms, which is a large hog processing facility, is just locating in one of these areas, and they're going to use about maybe eventually 2.7 million gallons a day. City of Ames uses about 6. So, you know, we're talking about small city size, and they are also, because that plant is going to be there, they're also bringing in 19 new CAFO confinement operations, which will also use water. So there is concern about this, but overall, this is not a big issue, more than we thought. Okay, we're going to move to bedrock aquifers, and a lot of the stuff I've seen from all of you that have already talks about sampling in those. I had to remove some of those slides, but I do have them in case we have questions on them. But I'm going to talk mainly about a couple of karst areas in the northeast part of the state, mainly Big Spring and Manchester Spring, which are two springs that are probably well known to many of you, maybe Big Spring in particular. Big Spring is a really famous spring in Iowa because it's actually, this is all in the Ordovician galena, dolomite, and the Big Spring is a basin where there's actually been a groundwater basin defined for the spring, and all the outlet comes out here at Big Spring. So in that case, everything that's gone on in terms of land use in this particular area gets to the spring, and the spring shows what's going on, which has been a great place since the early 80s to study this. And George Hallbergs and others who were with the survey at that time actually looked at this and did a lot of neat stuff. And that is depicted on this diagram. So I'll walk you through this. This is nitrate in various scales. The nitrate nitrogen is on this outer scale. And this was one of the first times that we were able to actually see that if you take fertilizer, and this is sales data actually for this watershed, you can see that since the 60s, the fertilizer sales increased. They decreased in the payment in kind program, which some of you remember, and then it kind of fell off. But along with that, the Big Spring nitrate concentration increased during that time. So it was pretty good evidence for most of us to say that when you apply more fertilizer in a karst area like this, you get a response, and that response is to get more nitrate in the spring coming out. Now, the interesting thing was that during this time, the Extension Service really worked with some of the farmers up there to actually get control of their rates, and so the concentration stabilized, and then you got to the point where they quit doing that, and all of a sudden everybody started to use a little bit more fertilizer, even though it's not actually located here, and the numbers went back up. Okay, so this is about 2000. So at 2000 we were running maybe about maybe a little over 12. Okay, milligrams per liter is nitrate nitrogen. All right, so now let's look at what happens later. This is I guess it is pretty visible here. This is a plot. We have Nitratex, Hawk Nitratex sensors in many of the springs in the state now, and they record continuously. And you can see it for Big Spring that we start out at about 12 and we're still high, all right, through that entire period. And it doesn't really change that much. It goes down a little bit if it's dry. If you get a rainfall, you get a flush out, but it's still above 10. All right, Manchester Springs, even worse. All right, so these karst areas are pretty good signals for maybe what's not happening in terms of our conservation and other things on that landscape. It also speaks to the problems with shallow karst and getting stuff into those areas. And I'll bet you if you put a private well anywhere shallow in this area, you're going to get nitrate concentrations like that. So there is a public health kind of issue involved with that. Okay, so we're out of bedrock now, and I do have some other data for this stuff. Generally, we find in Iowa for the private wells, 60%, we've done about over 100,000 samples, 60% of those generally have some nitrate detection, and generally about 20% have over the MCL, 20% of those wells. All right, so that's a pretty huge number. All right, alluvial aquifers. So these are important because they make up about 27% of the total drinking water supply in the state. There are 700 private water supplies, public water supplies in the state, and about 1,900 total wells. So it's not an insignificant number in the state of Iowa for alluvial systems. So these are the alluvial aquifers of Iowa. Not a spectacular slide here, but it's the brown areas that have alluvium. So Iowa uses a lot of these. Missouri, Mississippi, and you can see right here in Ames that we're going to talk about in a second. So this is where I start in the lecturing mode, since I would be lecturing about this time, is please read this USGS book. If you're not familiar with USGS Circular 1139, Groundwater and Surface Water, a Single Resource. Part of my mission in life, among many missions, is to make people understand in the community that groundwater and surface water are not separate compartments that never talk to each other. All right? And a perfect example is what we have here in Ames. And actually, Tom Winter is a name familiar to many of you here. Surface water is not isolated from groundwater. In many areas, in alluvial aquifers, here's the situation that we have. We have a well. We have nitrate and other stuff in the stream, and we'll talk about that other stuff in a second. My feeling is that nitrate's just the tip of the iceberg in many of these areas of what's actually coming down there. You've reversed the gradient, you get some of that, and this is under the influence of surface water. You have that designation here in Minnesota. We have a more complicated definition in Iowa. Nevertheless, some of that water is coming from the stream in various amounts. So I'm going to show you a case that I've worked on for the last few years, and actually a student of mine, Adam Davidson, worked on. This is a cross-section of the downtown well field in the Ames Aquifer, which is the main aquifer for Ames. This is the part of the aquifer that's confined, and there's a till aquitard or confining unit on the top that's fairly thick. The aquifer that's pumped is down here, and there's the Skunk River is up here, and the ambient potentiometric surface slopes down like this, so that it actually water goes down into this deeper basin here and goes on down to the south. But in this case, because of pumpage down here, water is pulled out of the stream and actually gets pulled into the Ames Aquifer. And in fact, we actually have really good evidence of that on numerous fronts, and it's been known for like 40 years. So also, the 303D list has visited this part of the Skunk River ever since I've been at Iowa State. It's always been on there. So one of the things that we were interested in is if there was anything else in this water and how far it might track into the aquifer. Okay, so here is a map of the CAFOs and wastewater lagoons that are in the area. There's 134 confined animal feedery operations upstream of the point that we sampled here. And these wastewater lagoons are basically the water is thrown out and it decomposes magically and then it's just diluted out in the stream. There's no treatment process per se. Here is the setup. We sampled, we had four piezometers next to the stream. We sampled the stream. We did this seven times during a two-year period. We had a well in right here in the aquifer, and then two of the city wells that we sampled here with very long screens. And what we found was that we were looking for human enteric viruses, so norovirus, adenovirus, rotavirus, and enterovirus. And what we found here was that consistently we found adenovirus serotype 31 and genotype 3 hepatitis E virus in the stream. And then if you trace it on through, we found it basically coming into the aquifer as far as over a mile into the aquifer. All right. So it's pretty good evidence that we are pumping stuff from the stream. And it's not just nitrate. And we don't see nitrate because it's reduced, because the redox environment's pretty low. But we do see these hepatitis E viruses here. And hepatitis E is not unusual in the state of Iowa, because there's a recent paper by my collaborator, Mark Borkhart, who did a work up about an hour north of here in the South Fork watershed. And the word he described this as is this watershed is awash with hog manure and hepatitis E. There is manure management going on, but still there's overland runoff, there's tile drainage, and they find hepatitis E a lot and other pathogenic bacteria that's out there. All right, so this stuff is everywhere, I think, in Iowa. And again, streams communicating with aquifers, there's an issue there, I think. And Ames is now not considered under the influence of surface water. But if we but we found evidence that viruses are getting through that barrier, so they are looking at that again. And I keep preaching about that, but nobody listens. Okay. We heard about neonicotinoids. I have the same problem with pronunciation, but I'll just give you the background. They replaced their seed coatings, basically. They replaced many other insecticides that were less favorable. And you can see the distribution of them is fairly huge in the Midwest. They have just skyrocketed in their use. The most interesting thing was a study that was done at University of Iowa, that place that Minnesota is going to beat for football, I think, coming up here, right? Yeah, that other university in Iowa. They sampled source and finished drinking water in the Iowa River and also the alluvial well. So the Iowa River sample is the university system, and they found, and this is finished drinking water. This is all the way through the treatment plant, and they were finding neonics in their finished water as well as their source water. The city gets theirs from alluvial wells that are right next to the Iowa River, and they found it too. A little different distribution here. But the message is here that there's a lot of stuff in these streams that we're not even looking at and that we're likely pumping into our systems. For viruses, we can disinfect them, but obviously we're not doing anything with neonics because they've ended up in the drinking water. And this is tap water that they actually sampled here. So again, another public health issue that I think is of note. Okay. So now we're going to talk about groundwater and tilth of the Des Moines Law, which, as many of you know, is one of my favorite topics. And I had to figure out a way to work that in here. So here it is. So in Iowa, there is this thing called the Des Moines Lobe. It made kind of a passing glance through Minnesota, I believe, on the way down to Des Moines. But there's a reason it's called the Des Moines Lobe, and that's because it ended up in Des Moines, all right, and not in Olivia or somewhere else. Okay, so in any case, this has a really interesting history. During the time when glaciers were coming down here during the Wisconsin, it turns out, Wisconsin time, that in Iowa things were actually pretty warm, and there was actually a luss, the Peoria luss was actually sitting on the surface, and there were maybe mastodons running around with tamaracks and spruce and all kinds of stuff. There was a forest growing here. And Minnesota was a lot colder. You don't see this as much, okay? In Iowa, it was pretty warm, so we had a really nice coniferous forest. And what that left us was those trees that are growing on the luss. This is an intact log that is in the till, and this occurs very frequently. You can hardly do a drill hole without running into this. Jim Item knows this, right, Jim? The idea here is that this provides a huge organic carbon source. It's also a lot of datable material for the quaternary people. But it actually is DOC rich. Some of the concentrations in the till get up to 50 milligrams per liter of dissolved organic carbon. All right, so what we found from this was that as part of this advance in the glacial history, you've got a zone here where the nitrate, let's see if I can get this up, where is it going? Here we go. The nitrate moves freely in the upper oxidized zone, and it's basically where the methane starts to be produced. The nitrate's denitrified immediately, and you never see it. So if we hadn't done any drainage in the state of Iowa, we might have had a really nice way to get rid of all the nitrate, because sitting down below it at about 15 feet is a ton of carbon that will do that. And we estimate probably 200 to 300 years worth of carbon that would probably do that. The other interesting thing we found is that till is fractured in the upper part of the oxidized zone. This is work of Martin Helmke. We have a poster on this that Nathan Young, my graduate student, is continuing some of this work. You can see the fractures as iron staining there. And this is about 3.3 meters. More spectacular is when you look at it and put dye in it, and you can see that there's a preferential flow direction along those fracture planes and not in the rest of the matrix. This is brilliant blue dye. So we are convinced that the dominant nitrate movement here is, in at least in Iowa, is along those fractures. And if you do those tracer tests, this is a little fuzzy, but you'll notice that we get almost immediate arrival times here in the order of 20 minutes, whereas in a typical breakthrough curve, you'd see a long, you know, kind of hesitancy, and then it would go up. And these don't look anything like what you find in a regular porous media, so it's not, all right? So we have a system here that's got a lot of organic carbon deeper, and it's got fractures up near the top. Well, what a great place to put drainage. All right. So this is a kind of a neat topic right now for a lot of reasons. Here is what the Des Moines lobe surface probably looked like after glaciation, after the ice had receded. It was prairie pothole country. This picture is actually from North Dakota. I didn't do a time machine and go back or anything like that. Here's the land, and then, of course, it eventually gave away to a land-grant university in Iowa State University and employed me. So there's a lot of history here that goes back thousands of years. In any case, the decision was made that this was a difficult place to do business, all right? At statehood in 1846, which all Iowans have to memorize, the Des Moines Lobe was a swamp. It made travel very difficult, and malaria was very common. So the decision was made to institute drainage through drainage districts. That began in about 1890, and a constitutional amendment was passed in 1908 to allow the drainage districts eminent domain to establish and maintain drainage districts and levy taxes. There were trustees for each of these drainage districts. There was no overall plan to creating these drainage districts. They just did it, all right? So as a result of that, you have 3,000 drainage districts in the state of Iowa. 61% of them are probably in the Des Moines Lobe. We drained 85 to 90% of the wetlands. And about one-third of all the row crop farmland in Iowa is drained. It's the part that isn't drained. It isn't drained. Anyway, the point here is that we have an extensive drainage system, and it actually is the outline of the Des Moines Lobe. We have some tile drainage out here, but it's not as much, and it's not as organized. These are very organized entities, but they're not governmental entities at all. They are a board of trustees that are just normal folks, okay? And then they are overseen by the board of supervisors, usually for the counties. All right, now we get into the interesting stuff. If it hasn't been interesting up to this point, this is the real interesting stuff. Okay. Chapter 468 of Section 2 of Iowa Code says that the drainage of surface waters from ag lands and other lands or the protection of such lands from overflow shall be presumed to be a public benefit and conducive to the public health, convenience, and welfare. So back in the code, this is how the drainage districts were set up, to basically with the idea that drainage would benefit everybody in the public, hence the eminent domain and everything else. So away we went. We dug big channels with steam shovels. We eventually started with clay pipe, but we put in plastic pipe later. We're actually putting tile on tile, and because nobody really knows where many of the farm level tiles are, and we were getting so much rain earlier in the year that people want to add more tiles, so we're tiling on top of tile systems, and you can't go anywhere in Iowa without actually seeing a tile drainage operation going in. We also had to have big ditches. This is one that drained a former lake. These are people down here. This is a culvert like you've never seen. So you get the impression that there's a lot of water moving, and they expect a lot of water moving if you were going to size one at this point. This actually drained a thing called Lake Cairo, and Lake Cairo was a lake, and they decided they wanted to farm it. So they just broke the drainage divide, sent it out on a ditch, put the tile into it, and actually further down towards the Skunk River, this actually has a gauging station on it. So you can look it up on the USGS site. Cool. Okay. So here, this is a salient point here. We lowered the water table in many of these areas probably as much as 2 meters. I looked up a bunch of diagrams here that indicate that effect. Here is drainage. Here you can see the water table dipping in the vicinity of the tile. Here's the water table dipping in the tile. Here is a really nice one that shows the drain saturated zone. Water table's dipping to the tiles. Okay, this is what you'd expect. All right, here's one from the University of Minnesota Extension. The author of this is probably in the room. I really like the tiles gushing out here in the side here. That's really a very nice effect. The point is that it's fairly clear that the water table is being drawn down by the tiles, okay? And that's a very important point. And it has a lot to do with a lot of other effects that probably the people that set these up didn't know about. For instance, you might affect groundwater recharge by putting in tile drains, all right? So the stuff that's maybe moving downward may never get there. We might affect base flow in the streams, and I define base flow as the contribution of groundwater, not what we're measuring at any one time, because base flow in these areas is really been modified by having so much tidal flow into them, all right? Base flow is groundwater. And so, and then finally, you think about lakes, what you're doing here is you're flattening out that water table, all right? Now, this is an extreme example. Some of you guys in my class will recognize this diagram here from Hubbard, but you're flattening it out. So, in fact, the divides are not as high, they're flattened down, and you're pushing out less water to some of these other units. All right, now along with that is some really interesting stuff. This is the salient work of Jim Idom in a JEQ paper in 1999. Thank you, Jim. Jim is smiling. Said he never thought he'd use that. Okay. In any case, you see a lot of nitrate at depths below the tile zone. I've had arguments with people. Well, you know, the tiles are sweeping out all the nitrate. Baloney. All right? Here is 30 to 40 milligrams per liter in the till running around down there. We thought maybe the tiles were sweeping that out up here, but it's still down there. So there's legacy down there of stuff that could come in. So in any case, the nitrate that you see in a particular tile, it may be the recent nitrate. It might be old nitrate. This gets to the old new water kind of stuff. But the point is, it's groundwater. This is all saturated zone sampling here. All right. Thank you, Jim, for that contribution. I should have had him talk about it, but we didn't have time. All right. So what does this have to do with litigation, which is the final thing in my title? And I really like this. This is, I hate to say it, there are very few judge icons that are women or people of color. It's just astounding. I hate to say that, but the only guy, so that I just did this because it's a good caricature of most judges that we have ever met, I think. So I want to talk about the Des Moines Waterworks case a little bit because it ties in to what's going on in the till. It goes into where the nitrate's coming from, and it goes into really a whole different look on a kind of a macro scale of what's going on. The Waterworks is an independent utility, and that's important. It's 500 residents are served by it. It's the largest water utility in Iowa, and it is supported by the Raccoon and Des Moines River sources. I love this thing. No water, no coffee. Boy, that really hits home, doesn't it? Yeah, seriously. And this is the Waterworks that went totally down in 1993 when the floods hit Des Moines and they got in the Clearwater tanks and they had to shut the Waterworks down for a month. That hasn't happened recently. So they get their water here in Des Moines. They get the water from a series of different branches of the North Raccoon River, which is up here, and I apologize for not having a great slide here. And then it also gets water from the Des Moines River watershed, and they blend those, okay? So they blend them to get down to a concentration that they can actually use to get down below 10 milligrams per liter of nitrate. All right, so we are looking at motivation. Suddenly, in about 2012 and 2013 in particular, the concentrations increased to greater than 10 milligrams per liter in the Raccoon, and they stayed there. There used to be a seasonality to it, and what they would do is in the spring sometimes, they would switch to using more Des Moines River water, and then back in the winter where there wasn't much stuff going on, they'd switch back to mostly the Raccoon. All right, well, the problem is if that's staying up, that's a problem. And if the Des Moines is also staying up, that's a problem. So they got nowhere to blend down the water to 10 milligrams per liter. All right, they also started looking up into the watershed, and they sampled 72 sample sites in those three counties, which are way up in the watershed, and they showed nitrate concentrations of 39.2 milligrams per liter up to that, and many of them are above 20 that were in the ditches and in the tile drains. Okay, now, to further prove show this point, this is the USGS Raccoon River at Van Meter, Iowa, which is just at the confluence, close to the confluence of those three branches. You can see here in 2013, it was running at 20. It's never run at 20. So all of a sudden, we're getting a lot of nitrate. And then you'll notice through here, it's staying over 10. I mean, here's the 10 line. I guess I should have, you know, highlighted that for you. All right, and then it went down, and it was dry during this part, and now it's come back up. So there was alarm that was raised here. Now, if you go, I don't have as long a record, and they have a nitrotax sensor at the Van Meter gauge, so where this is where this comes from. This is the Des Moines River at 2nd Avenue in Des Moines, which is just upstream, and this is kind of where they close to where they take the water. And they take the water by both Infiltration galleries, they also use radio collector wells. I mean, there's a bunch of different things that they use to pull the water in. But it's basically river water. And you can see here we're above 10, here we're above 10. And it may look like it's going down, but, you know, we had a dry period here, and as soon as the water gets back up, I'm sure it's going to go back up, things are going to flush through. So what do? Well, you build a huge nitrate removal system. It's ion exchange, and it costs about $7,000 a day to run. So the question is, why would a water utility pay $7,000 a day to have water that is not being polluted by them, but maybe by somebody else? And so they decided, based on that and a few other things here, that to sue those three counties and the Board of Supervisors, which are now overseeing the drainage districts there. The suit was filed in March 11, 2015. You can see how long I've been preparing for this talk today. Seriously. It was filed against the Board of Supervisors in their capacity as the trustees of those of 10 drainage districts in those three counties. All right, you have to sue a governmental agency. So the drainage districts are not really governmental agencies. So they have this kind of gray area in terms of being able to do things, and that actually plays into this as well. Okay, so they sued these three counties. Lawsuit involves the Clean Water Act, which most of you know regulates point sources, but specifically exempts normal, quote, agricultural activities, and in particular, this mysterious concept of agricultural stormwater discharge. All right, the lawsuit, the end game of the lawsuit was to reverse that agricultural exemption and to enforce NPDES regulation for drainage tiles. Yeah, all right, and I got that from the waterworks themselves. Pretty scary thing. This is something that everybody has feared, and the Des Moines Waterworks decided to go for it. So here's a little bit of the timetable, boring stuff, but hopefully it'll read like a novel for you. Lawsuit filed in federal district court up in Fort Dodge, the Northern District of Iowa, Judge Michael Bennett. Bennett was a fairly liberal judge, so it's no coincidence that it was filed at the time that it did. Trial was supposed to begin in August of 16. There was an initial summary judgment to basically throw it out. That was denied. The defense made numerous motions, one of which to show that drainage tiles were insignificant to the whole problem. That failed. And in 2016, when it was about time for the trial to begin, the judge sent four questions of certification to Iowa Supreme Court. So we have a Supreme Court in Iowa, as you do in Minnesota, I think, I hope, all right? And I don't know. I haven't done my homework very well. And so they had oral arguments in September of 2016, and in January 27, 2017, there was a decision from the Supreme Court, and the idea was that they would report back to the judge about those four questions. Basically, they all had to do with the intent of the drainage districts when they were set up and whether they can still be immune under today's present circumstances. And basically, the response was, in a 3-2 vote, that the remedy for damages and cost of treatment for the Des Moines Waterworks should be decided by the legislature. In other words, the damages or the remedy should not be enforced by the drainage districts. All right, this was a setback, but the federal court thing could still go on because we still have the non-point discharge elimination system thing hanging out there. All right, in the meantime, this is when it got very interesting for people that are kind of political junkies like myself. The defense created the Ag Legal Defense Fund and raised about $2 million in tax-deductible funds. I'm not sure how they did that because it was essentially a political action committee. Soybean Association, Corn Growers, and Farm Bureau all weighed in on this. The counties actually were suspicious of where the money was coming from. They asked them to reveal the donors, and they said no. So there's some suspicion that there was a lot of dark money coming from other places. And most of you that have read that book know what I'm talking about. The Des Moines Waterworks spent about $1 million to try the case. They decided not to appeal it because in the end they didn't win. They might have spent $5 million total, so they decided against that option and their board voted against it. The other interesting thing is that 63% of the Iowans wanted the case to go forward to trial. It wasn't like there was a mass, incentive not to do this. All the time that there were commercials on the airwaves throughout Iowa panning the Des Moines Waterworks for doing this and painting the waterworks director as nothing less than Darth Vader in most cases. There was a Clean Water Alliance that was formed to break up the Des Moines Waterworks. So here we have an alliance that was agreed to by the city council that wanted to break up a public water utility. This scares the heck out of everybody, I think. And finally, a state senator from rural Hull, Iowa, which is way outside the Des Moines district, proposed to break up this in legislation. Now, fortunately, the bill died in session, but there's some indication that they may revisit that again. They want to break up the Des Moines Water Works so that they will never do this again, apparently. So the Des Moines Register came back and said, back off. I thought this was great. I mean, this was like a half-page ad in the Register. Okay, cool. All right, I'm almost done here, so Evan, don't get nervous. So on March 17th, the judge dismissed the nitrate suit, and you can see on the indication of the basketball team that this was not a good decision. And I think we won this game. Anyway, on March 17th, the judge had changed. Bennett wanted to retire, but the defense succeeded, in most people's minds, in delaying the case so that Bennett would retire by the time the case came to trial. All right? And so Judge Leonard Strand was more conservative, and he agreed with the Iowa Supreme Court and threw the ball to the Iowa legislature for a remedy. And as I've talked to three attorneys about this, the issue was really redressability. And as whether should damages be assessed to an entity that was not created to control pollution. When these were built, they were built for the public good to drain. They were not; they had no knowledge of the fact that there would be any pollution, so they should now not be obligated to do so. The judge was also reluctant to contradict the Iowa Supreme Court, and from the tea leaves that I've read, also very reluctant to set precedent in a case in Iowa that may affect the entire United States. And I'm not kidding, there was a large view that that this was actually gonna go to the Supreme Court at some point. So this Mark Cady was he's the Chief Justice in the Supreme Court. You can read this, but I think he says it very clearly that, you know, yeah, they didn't know at the time, but if they thought at the time it could be, there should have been a remedy that would be available to them. And this is his words at the end: pollution of our streams is wrong irrespective of its source or cause. And I totally agree with that, in case you don't wonder about that. Now, at the end here, I'm just going to say what the defense strategy was. And this is where it really, really gets interesting. You can read through this, all right? And this is actually from a conversation that Doug Gross, former Republican governor candidate really large power broker in the city of Des Moines, the state of Iowa, for politics, said basically that they are saying that stormwater is not stormwater, it's groundwater. So at the end of the day, the question is, what is groundwater and what is stormwater? And then it gets more interesting. This is a great interview, and I just caught it by going online. Agricultural stormwater includes water that is precipitated from the air and infiltrates through the ground and then is discharged by the drainage tiles regardless of where that drainage tile is placed. So the question comes down to how the court will determine what groundwater is. Now, this was widely distributed. So basically the argument was, as I understand it, that the plaintiffs were saying it was groundwater coming through the tiles, which I hope I've demonstrated. The defense said, no, it's precipitation. And we can't control precipitation, so therefore we can't do anything about it. Think about that for a second. I think I'll give you all a quiz on how to define groundwater before we leave, and that would be a good thing to do. So now what? Okay, so we have this situation in Iowa where we're still fighting about this, all right? We have thousands of hog operations. I don't have the exact number, and a lot of concern about groundwater. The answer, of course, is to become more like Minnesota. This was an article that was in the May 22nd edition of the Des Moines Register, and it was on the front page. Does Minnesota have the solution to better water? And I read this with excitement. I actually... Okay, so I got to get done here. But anyway, let's just talk about the things that I was not doing that you all are doing here. First of all, here's the things that Iowa could do. It could pass the 3.8-cent sales tax increase to fund our Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Fund. We passed the Iowa Water Land Legacy Amendment in 2010 by 63% of the voters, and it's just been sitting there. This $150 million that it would generate could fund more DNR monitoring, more monitoring by everybody, groundwater research like you're doing here. It could fund a lot of stuff. DNR in Iowa has had a flat budget for the last 7 years. They've had no raises. All right, so this could do a lot of stuff. I'm not big on tax increases, but I think it's important. The other thing is, this was a editorial that somebody said. It says, "Just let's just quit winking at water quality and actually do something. Be proactive. You have a riparian buffer rule that's just come into effect. You're anticipating rules on fertilizer application. This is what I call being proactive. And it's proactive because, I hate to say it, but this thing is not going to go away. All right? People know that this clean water rule exemption is out there, and there's a lot of interest in doing something about it. All right? And if you're in the business of agriculture, I think the prudent course is to get on top of it and look for ways that you don't have to rely on tile drains, because at some point somebody may have a discharge permit waiting for you. All right? That's my doomsday prediction for today. Okay. A lot of acknowledgments here. Ton of people that I interviewed as part of this over the last 3 months, I think, when Evan called me. And I also want to just invite you all to the GSA North Central Section meeting, which I am chairing next April. The abstract deadline is January 16th, and we have no less than 10 sessions on water, including an ag water quality and hydrology session, which all of you could submit to. And I invite you to come. And if you need help financially, we'll figure out a way to get you there. So thank you.
Questions? Thank you for the...
It's on.
Thank you for the interesting talk. Quick question, why do you think Des Moines Water Works chose the three counties that were so far removed? They were upstream, they were like 100 river miles away.
I'm trying to think if I know the answer to that question. I think it's it may have to do with the district. It may have to do with the boundaries of the northern district. So if they went further south, we'd be in the Des Moines district of the federal court. And so they may have filed in that district simply because they knew they had the judge that might be more favorable to it. And I'll have to check that out. And just remember, the Raccoon River itself is well known on, you know, Goolsbee stuff to, you know, to be a contributor to hypoxia. And most people think it's in the upper parts that the drainage districts are more concentrated up there. But it may have something to do with the court selection, I think. And I'll check that out. If you send me something on the online thing, I'll get back to you, because I know everybody in the business now. It's great. Yeah, so other questions?
Bill, do you have some information or insights into residence time for the Ames based on the lifespan of these HEV viruses?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Bob. So the question is residence time in the Ames aquifer. So we did some tritium helium dating at the bottom of that aquifer and at the top, and the top was about 4 years and the bottom was about 36 years. But the viruses, virus PCR genetic material generally only hangs around for about 2 or 3 years and then they don't find it anymore. So if you see it, you know that water, that package of water, probably is about 2 to 3 years old. That's gotten further in the aquifer than probably it should have based on our tritium helium dates. And there's been a lot of discussion recently about, in groundwater, in a paper by Randy Hunt, basically, that talked about viruses being really great tracers because they seem to get out in front of what we think they should be in and would cause us to be a little bit more conservative about, you know, our water protection stuff. So, yeah, great question. Our tritium dates are pretty young, but, you know, this is even younger. Yeah.
One question from Pigeonhole. Does Des Moines Water Works have bedrock wells for backup and blending?
Oh, gosh. I don't think so. I think, and the problem I think may be that there's that Dyco Superfund site just to the northwest. And it may be that there's some issues with the wells that are contaminated there, and they may not want to pull them in. So, And they still have an ASR, yeah. And so they are, they've got a, they're pumping treated water down into the Jordan, or the, yeah, it is the Jordan, in several locations so that they avoid ever getting flooded out again. That's a whole interesting enterprise too, but yeah.
All right, I think we'll move on. Thank you, Bill. Okay.